Good morning, this is James Callaghan from Mindset Schools and Capital Psychotherapy. This is the second part of a third part series on neurodivergence. Today I'm joined by Robert Rackley, a neurodivergent psychotherapist. You can find Robert at info@robertrackley.ie. Good morning, Robert, and thank you for joining us for a second part.
Good morning and thanks for having me.
On our last section, we talked about neurodivergence, and it was a really interesting conversation. And, you know, we talked about the different types of it. And, you know, I think hopefully our listeners learned a lot from that. And if they can always go back and listen to it on the podcast. But today I want to ask you and pick your brain a bit more. And this is about kind of supporting emotional wellness in the home and the school. So neurodivergent children, they often experience anxiety and overwhelm and often shut down from what I see. In everyday life, what would this look like?
Yeah, so we're looking at there's anxiety out there, so we're looking at a difference here that's going to be quite sustained and look different. One of the areas that typically affects children is they have to do a thing called masking when they're at school. So masking is what the child will be doing naturally to try and make sure that their differences cannot be seen. So some of it's subconscious based and some of it then is conscious decisions to change and to fit in. So if a child is sitting all day in an environment that wasn't built for them, and they're holding themselves in a way where they're trying to pay attention, where they're trying not to move around, what you probably get then afterwards is what's seen as maybe a meltdown.
Yeah.
So the car journey, there might be irritation or real frustration. And then when you get home, there can typically be big explosive moments. So you can have a really good child in school, in inverted commas, and then when they get home. So the thing we want to notice as well with anxiety is it doesn't have to look typically. It can be complete withdrawal and it can be complete silence.
Yeah.
So you can be very anxious and be very silent. There's also avoidance. One of the major areas that I notice at the beginning is physical sensations. So that children are saying to their mothers or fathers, I have a sore stomach, or I feel. So they're noticing things like it could be like IBS type symptoms. And then you could have a child being brought to a doctor where they're trying to identify, okay, what's causing the stomach problems?
Yes.
And that can typically be a sign of a higher anxiety.
Okay. It's really interesting because sometimes whenever I'm speaking to parents, you know, they get a bit confused because they say the child's really good in school, and then whenever he comes home, he acts differently or he's a bit different with us. And I think what you're saying there is even by being able to understand what the child is going through and being able to know that there is masking going on, I think it puts a different slant on things.
And I like that you're saying that, because it's really important that we try and move away from noticing behaviour, because that's what everyone's going to see. Parents sometimes, unfortunately, and it's not bad parenting, it's just people, parents don't know this stuff, they weren't taught this. But you can have a school saying, I don't know what the problem is here, because your child is brilliant in school, so this must be something that's happening at home. And I've been involved with schools where there's a question, okay, what is going on at home? Because the child is really good here, and then at home, it's turning into chaos. And so that's the difference between a child that's sitting in an environment that wasn't built for them. The nervous system is then holding all that until they get home and they're releasing.
Yeah.
And so you're going to see those big swings, and they're really important to notice.
Okay. Whenever I think about masking, I'm thinking, okay, if I have someone who has ADHD, would masking be then about trying not to move off the chair, try to sit still? Would that be their version of masking?
Yeah, so masking will also, neurodivergent people feel the world differently through how they see, how they hear, smell, taste, touch. This is a different system for each child. So what you could have is a child who is struggling with bright lights.
Yeah.
And as these big fluorescent lights in school, a neurotypical person, someone without autism and ADHD, can naturally adjust to those environments. So the brain will make changes to bring those lights a little bit down, and so they won't be feeling that in their body.
Mm-hmm.
A neurodivergent child, if it's the fluorescent light, will feel that light through their nervous system, which means they're holding a really high level of anxiety based on something that's just as simple as a light or a sound or a smell that they find bad. Or it might be a label that's touching their skin or socks that are the wrong socks. And there's no language yet for that child to be able to express that. So now what you have is a child who's starting to develop an idea of, okay, I'm not the same as other people here, I'm different, but will internalise that. And now we're going to get into the trauma sides of internalised emotion and trying to hold on to things. And obviously children need to regulate.
Yeah.
And if they're not taught how to do that and we don't give them the tools and the understanding, then we're going to notice behaviour.
Yeah, of course. And there is an increase of people who have neurodivergence having trauma, right? There is a bit of a link there.
Absolutely. I mean, the statistic that always stays in my head is around ADHD. And by the time the average person with ADHD has arrived at 12, they've been directly insulted 20,000 times. Now, they're really subtle things that parents, teachers don't know what they're doing, but they still impact the nervous system. And so we're talking about really high levels of trauma with this. And so what that's about is the don't do that. Sit still. You can't do that. You, if it's around food, you need to eat the food. You need to finish your dinner. So the child doesn't know how to do this.
Yeah.
And so we're forcing the child into a position where it has to try and behave in a way that they're not built for. And so that's your internalised system of trauma then. That's how it begins.
Yeah, of course. And then, you know, to stop the child picking up, as was then the child would get low self-esteem, I assume, then if you're listening yes. to all of these negative comments. So then from a preventative point of view, would that be about the child maybe, you know, getting a good diagnosis and then the parents also going down the road of having parenting, you know, learning how to parent this child differently? Would that be the kind of solution to that then?
Yeah, so this is, diagnosis is hugely important. If you can think of it like, having a manual and you were told how to do this child-rearing thing. So there's a thing that we have in society and every parent knows what to do because we've told parents what to do. But what if parents have been given the wrong manual? What if there's a different manual? And what if when you follow that one, you have a totally different outcome? So then what you have is parents that have language, they have interventions that will actually work.
Yeah.
And you've got a child who can provide themselves with soothing techniques, who can start to learn that there's nothing wrong with having a difficulty with a bright light or a loud sound, just that I know what to do with that now. So now we're into the right language and the right interventions.
Yeah, exactly. It's a different way of understanding it, I suppose.
Yeah.
And whenever you're talking there about masking, in my mind, I was thinking about how complex and complicated a school can be because you're going from one classroom to another and there's noise going on. And, you know, it's quite a complex environment whenever I think about schools. Is there like a typical masking thing or symptom that a lot of children or adolescents might try to, like that they struggle most with in schools?
So communication can be really difficult.
Okay.
Most neurodivergent people have a different way of communicating. And the communication style for neurotypical people is quite a lot of verbal. And that verbal stuff is really complicated. So there's lots of untold rules around how social interactions go. And with those social interactions, a lot of the time it can be very difficult for a child to understand what to say, what to do, how am I in a group? And then within that, you've got a child then who is in a group of people who doesn't understand the rules properly, who now will do a thing called masking or mimicking. You're learning the behaviour. You're learning how to communicate. And that kind of puts you on the outside, like you're participating in the group from the outside, not a core part of it. So communication is going to be a real difficulty.
Okay. I've heard a lot of different terms, which I'm not too familiar with, but I might just pick your brain on a few different things. Time blindness is something that I hear a lot of people having difficulty with, in that they really struggle to know what an hour feels like or what a few minutes, you know, which in my mind, it can be quite complex to live in that world. How would you describe time blindness?
So time blindness is, it explains an awful lot. When you start looking at things from the correct viewpoint and you put the right lenses on, then you see something very different. So the child that's never on time, that you're dragging out of bed in the morning, that you're trying to get the child into the car and they're always late. and everything is last minute. What if that wasn't behaviour? And what if this was time blindness, a totally different relationship with understanding time? So if you think of a child who, you know, repeatedly, there's the same problems, that they're always running late or nothing's being done in the right order in time. What if there was a thing, a name called time blindness,
yes,
that explained their relationship with time? The strategies around this. But if you keep pushing a child and expect to, we need to be there at nine. And with time blindness, if you consider that, that repeated process of telling a child that we just need to be there without the right intervention means that you're forcing a child into a position it can never understand.
Yes.
Because with time blindness, you develop strategies around it, but it will stick with you. And time blindness also means that people don't often think back through their lives in chronological order. And also, children looking into the future can get very scared with time blindness, because if you look into the future, you can't fully understand what the future means. It's an unusual concept. Then a huge amount of fear can come with that, and overthinking related to what's ahead. And so a lot of the times, children are
worried, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anxiety. Okay. And is there any tips you can give in terms of trying to manage time blindness then?
Yeah, so teaching is important. Visualization is absolutely huge. Predictability is really good. And in particular, move away from criticism. Don't criticize the child for being late. Show them, give them strategies, go through step by step, break it down into really small chunks. Have visual calendars, have visual times. There's plenty, if you look at time blindness related to autism and ADHD online, you're gonna see an enormous amount of strategies. Once you're using one of those, we're now working within what the child can actually do.
Yeah, amazing. Another thing that I've heard about is sensory processing disorder. What is that?
So that's where the sensory world, with autism and ADHD, the change that happens in the brain, it affects all systems, but everybody's different with this. So we were speaking about the idea of a sound that you could feel. So this is a nervous system response. And this means that a loud sound that comes into your ear can hit your body, hit your nervous system, and create emotion. So you could be angry by a sound.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an instant anger or instantly anxious. So unless we're identifying the sound or the sight part or the smell, then we could have children moving into anxiety responses and becoming angry really quickly and be missing the fact that they might be experiencing the sensory world in a different way.
And that must also be very draining then, if that's going on, if noises are affecting children, that must be quite draining as well, is it?
Absolutely. And if we think of this as a bucket, this is a sensory bucket that's filling all day. And the more that fills, as you get to the top of that bucket, you're going to be into higher anxiety, higher depression, lower self-esteem. As it gets to the top, it gets really deep. And the bucket will overflow. And you're going to see that then. Typically, parents will see that as behaviour and as bad behaviour. And that child might get criticised for that bad behaviour. And they might not know how to regulate because nobody's told them about the sensory world that they're experiencing.
And if a parent had this and the child was experienced these sensations, what can a parent do about it then? How can they help?
So luckily, on the sensory world, there's loads of options here.
Hmm.
For example, if your child had a difficulty with bright lights, if they had sunglasses going in and out of school, that's going to take that bucket down a little bit. Or there's loads of different, you can get noise cancelling headphones, you can wear music, you can get things called loops where you stick them in your ears to bring the sound down. You can have comforting things that you have in your hand. You can have nice smells. You can have maybe a little sweet or something that goes in the mouth. So once you start exploring the sensory profile, then you can make interventions that suit your individual child.
Yes.
Rather than waiting till the end of the day and then criticising them for having bad behaviour because they're overwhelmed sensory-wise.
Okay, so it's really good to hear that there's lots of practical things that can be done.
Absolutely.
And I think going back to what we're talking about, once you understand what's going on for the child or their lesson, it's about understanding their world and then being able to adapt to it. Something that I come across a lot of times is sometimes children might self-harm or engage in those sort of behaviours. Is this something that would be quite common with neurodivergence?
Yes, and I would ask parents to consider, everyone is terrified when they see a child, obviously, self-harm. It could be very, very disturbing. What I would ask, you obviously need to get support around this, but don't panic. The panic won't help this situation at all. Unfortunately, an overwhelmed system will try and express it in some sort of way. It's going to be trying, the child will try and cope. And one of the ways that a child learns to cope, unfortunately, is through something like self-harm. If we look at kind of the lower levels of this, it can be skin picking, it can be hair pulling, it can be biting your nails. We can teach that child how to do this different. We could teach this child how to use a different coping mechanism rather than going to self-harm. And if you're having your divergent child and you're using the correct strategies, that starts to reduce quite quickly. And normalizing and having conversations, if there's self-harm going in, talk about it. Talk to your child about it. Don't go silent. Don't give out to the child either. Criticism with self-harm will not work. So we, and it's the natural response is, you know, there's grounding and there's, you can't do this. We, if we go in nice and calm as parents, even though this will be really, really difficult to do, then we're providing safety for the child to talk about what's happening. And now the interventions will start working in a totally different way.
And I love the way that you mentioned the word we, you know, as in we're all in this together, and we can get different ways of coping for a very difficult experience the child is having.
Absolutely.
So that's a really powerful message. One last thing before we finish up, is there, what one thing out of all of that we've talked about today, what one thing do you think that teachers or schools could change that could help the school life of a child or adolescent?
So with schools, schools often panic with this stuff, and they think, God, what do we have to do here? All the changes, how are we going to do this? Actually, in my experience of working with schools is, if you have a lot of small interventions work really well. And normalizing of these adjustments are really good. Things say, on a practical level, what can schools do? They can provide very clear instruction to children. They can try and limit change. Or if something's about to happen during the day, and a neurodivergent knows that this child knows that this is about to happen, they will be able to sit better with the change when it does happen. Movement breaks, the sensory world. I mean, we could go into it for hours.
But, yeah. And in our next section, we're going to talk more about it. Robert Rackley, thank you so much.
Thank you.